Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Natasha Courtney-Smith, who is the co-founder of Bolt Digital. Bolt Digital are the specialist in direct-to-consumer accelerated growth for beauty, lifestyle and healthcare brands.
My name is Tash Courtney-Smith and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Bolt Digital. But Alice, you and I met, we were just trying to figure it out around 6 or 7 years ago. At the time, I'd just sold an online press agency business called Talk to the Press, and I'd written a book called The Million Dollar Blog, and you'd just started Blogosphere magazine, I think, at the time.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been that long already. I remember doing that that interview. You were in your garden shed. You had writing, is that right?
Yes, I was in my garden shed. I finished the book in my garden shed, and then I started Bolt Digital in my garden shed.
Brilliant. And so could you tell our listeners a bit about your career? So you'd obviously sold a business at that time, but where did you start out? Let's have a little overview of your career.
Yeah, sure. So I started out on women's magazines. So I was absolutely obsessed with the women's magazines, as we all were back then. You know, magazines were highly glamorous, very, very aspirational. And I just remember reading magazines all the way through my teenage years, like just 17, and I think then B came out, and thinking these things were so fabulous. I looked forward to them so much. I then would sit and read and reread, and I just loved them, the photography, the words, the stories and everything. So I then, when I finished uni, I hadn't studied journalism, didn't have a degree in journalism. I just thought, I want to work on a women's magazine. I started phoning around women's magazines to find out about getting a job, and they were also saying, have you got a journalism degree? Have you got your NCTJ qualification? And which I had none of it. But at the same time, I was a qualified fitness instructor and I'd been teaching aerobics part-time at uni. And I thought, right, if I go to a fitness magazine and tell them I'm an instructor and I've got a qualification, then maybe I can help them save some money in writing their fitness copy. So I started sort of niching down into the health and fitness magazines and phoning around. And that's what happened. That's how I got my first job on a magazine. Phoned up health and fitness magazine. They did the usual, do you have an NCTJ qualification? And I said, no, but I am an aerobics instructor. So I can write some fitness copy for you. And that's how I got work experience. And from there, went through various magazines and ended up at the Daily Mail for nearly 4 years. And then subsequently set up Talk to the Press, which is a story brokering agency. It sold content into all of the tabloids, some of the women's magazines, daytime television shows, and very much dealt with sort of news content and ordinary families who were being caught up in the headlines.
What was it like working at the Daily Mail at that time for 3 years, and where did you get the sort of impetus to have that entrepreneurial spirit to set up?
Well, the Daily Mail is famously a very tough place to work, and it is tough, you know, there's no training. You just arrive and you sort of sit down and you have to start writing, and it's very much a sink or swim environment, and lots of people don't like it, but I did like it. You know, I enjoyed it. I liked going out and about. I liked going around the country. I knew it was a tough environment, but I sort of was fine with that. I had a great group of friends there. But then I saw the world in which, I guess I'd always thought I would run my own business. My parents were entrepreneurs and ran a business together. And then I started thinking about my career, and I noticed that, you know, the network of press agencies who were basically selling content into the Daily Mail, at the same time to really, you know, do well at the Daily Mail and become one of their sort of famous journalists, I sort of thought, God, I'm going to have to be here like 10 years or 20 years to get the status that some of these journalists have. They have been there that long. You know, they've got the longevity of time on a national newspaper. So I started thinking, I can't stay here for 20 years. I'm going to set up one of these press agency things that all these people are sort of phoning into Daily Mail with stories. You know, what are they doing? It looks simple enough. I'll set up a press agency. So I didn't really think or know about entrepreneurship. You know, it wasn't that long ago, as in it was 2008, but the world was really different then. Entrepreneurship wasn't something that people talked about. It wasn't a word in mass utilization like it is today. There wasn't the whole hustle, side hustle. All of that stuff came out subsequently. In fact, I remember when it came out, was you know, around about, I think, 2012, 2013, people started saying to me, you know, you're a great entrepreneur, and what you've done is really entrepreneurial, as that word kind of became more and more mass market. And it was at that point, which is, the business was about 3 years old, so this isn't amazing, this isn't a good entrepreneurship story, but I'd had the business for 3 years, and I suddenly sort of dawned on me, you know, I had a team and stuff, and it suddenly dawned on me, oh, right, I'm actually running a business, I am an entrepreneur, I'm not a journalist, I've made a transition into being a business owner and operator, and I'm an entrepreneur. And at that point, I joined James Kahn's Entrepreneurs Business Academy, which was one of the most powerful things I've done, in that it helped me understand the framework. Because, you know, we didn't grow up watching TikTok where everyone's talking about entrepreneurship, and it helped me understand that this is a business. This is what a business is. This is what it does. It sounds ridiculous. I had a business, but it helped me understand that a business in itself is a thing and an asset, and it's something that can be created and molded. And I didn't really have that context for it before, because I was, until that point, had seen myself as very much a journalist. And I was quite a passionate journalist. I was very into journalism. So doing James Kahn's Entrepreneurs Business Academy really helped me shift the way I thought, and made me think, okay, I am a journalist, but I'm also a business owner. And then I started to think about what I was doing quite differently.
You mentioned there that you learned to see the business as an asset that you can mould it. What were your other key learnings from that course?
Really, that a business has, you know, that a business can grow and start to operate without its creator, the person who's created it. And it was quite good timing for me, because I also had young children, and I really needed the business to operate without me, because of the fact that I had one baby and then would go on to have another baby. So as I started to see that in that framework of a business is like this, and this is how it's set up and structured, and it's an asset, and the business was the creator, can bring people in to do their roles, and they therefore are then not in the business, as in the key deliverable person doing all the work in the business. It really helped me.
Well, that leads to the scale, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really helped me accelerate what I was doing, which I needed to do because of the fact I had kids and I couldn't physically be the person. I had tiny children, I couldn't physically be the person in the business all of the time. So it just helped me think about things more clearly and, you know, more strategically, I think.
So how many years did you run the business in total, and when did the decision come to sell?
So I ran it for 6 years in total, which is a really short period of time. And it was so funny, because there's so many highs and lows in running a business, and there were various moments along that way where, you know, things wouldn't be going so well or whatever. I'd have the kids and I was exhausted and worn out, and I'd be thinking, oh my God, I'm, you know, am I trapped in this business forever, and how am I going to cope? And I found so many elements of it sometimes quite, it has that thing of being amazing, exhilarating, and also quite frightening. And I used to think, what is this, what I'm going to do? You know, how's this going to pan out? And if I'd known that actually it would only be 6 years from when I started it to when I was able to sell it to a big news organ, it was sold to Southwest News, I would have had a totally different viewpoint on the way through. Because once it was completed and sold and moved on, you talk to the press still operates today, it's still in an industry leading position. You then think, all those highs and lows were totally worthwhile, and I really shouldn't have been so worried about it as I went along.
So when you did sell it, it was just like a great feeling, and it made everything worth it.
It was a great, it was a high and a low. So first of all, it was a great feeling because I sold it in a great way to Southwest News, and I thought that was an amazing outcome. It also made me realise that all the stress, some of the stressful moments along the way, I hadn't needed to worry about it so much, because it was all going to be okay. And actually 6 years wasn't. Because sometimes, you know, you think, oh my God, am I going to be doing this business the rest of my life? I'm going to do this 20 years, this is going to be too much. And it's like, well, actually, it was only a 6 year stint, and it was great. But then it's also, you know, quite sad and hard to sell a business, because firstly, I was on a no-compete agreement. So to not immediately set up the same business, which meant I couldn't really work for anyone I'd worked for previously for 2 years. So it was kind of like I was out of an industry. And then, you know, you sold your business, but everyone else's life is continuing as normal. So then you're like, okay, so I've had this kind of amazing experience, and I'm now basically unemployed and also can't work in my industry. And I don't have anyone to talk to about this. Nobody else understands what it is or how it feels. So you're kind of pushed into a career transition, which is a positive thing. But it's also, I think, particularly as a woman, you know, a guy might be very gung-ho. Yeah, now I'm going to do this. That's not how I felt. I felt like half of me felt like that, and the other half of me felt like, wow, I'm now going to enter a period of really massive change in my life, and I'm not sure where that's going to take me. But the things I do know is that I've sold a business, which is great and positive, and I can no longer work as a journalist for 2 years. So I need to use those 2 years to find something different to do, and I have to really have faith in myself that I will be able to find something different to do.
And it was during those 2 years that you, am I right, that you started writing and completed the book?
I started writing the Million Dollar Blog, yeah, because I, one of the ways, and you know, when you think about bloggers, you often think about the blogger being a person, and also Alison, in this industry has changed so much as well, because back then, you know, when you started out, it was about blogs, and the main force of things was hosted on a website, not in the way that we now have all the social channels up front ahead of any website. So what I did was talk to the press. As part of the success of that business was a blogging strategy. So we'd use blogs, content, and my personal brand within that niche that we were in to first of all rank for SEO, which meant that we'd always outranked, you know, once the national newspapers realized what I was doing, they all set up, so the Sun and the Mirror set up story sourcing websites in competition. But because we ran such an aggressive blogging strategy, it was incredible that even now Talk to the Press still will rank for the main keyword above the Sun and the Mirror and all everyone else who set up in competition. And that was a function of having basically just been wholly committed to blogging and content. Plus, we built my personal brand, which is something all influencers do today, but in a niche of, you know, journalism and support for families who were facing media attention.
And so you had used it, the blog, you've got your SEO strategy. Did you pitch then the book in, or were you approached to write the book? What was that process like, and how did the publishing sort of work? Did you have to send, you know, write the book and then send it, or did you were you commissioned to write it? And
yeah, so I was commissioned to write the book. So I can't remember how I was introduced to Hachette, who are the publishers, and their subdivision Practice, who actually posted that first book. But somebody I knew said, oh, Hachette are looking to build out a division of books on blogging and business. And I was a journalist, you know, so I was actually a journalist. So that really put me in a great position that I was able to go to Hachette, basically discuss with them what sorts of things they're looking for. So at the time, blogging was huge, and in the way of becoming an influencer is now. So they said, well, we really want to write a book about blogging. And I thought, brilliant, I can write that from the truth of what we did for Talk to the Press, and then I can go out and source interviews with bloggers who are themselves the kind of the early influencers about what they're doing. And then together we'll have a book about blogging that covers both how to use it within your business for expertise, thought leadership, SEO, you know, slightly more dull stuff, but nonetheless really, really important. Plus we'll have the rising tide of bloggers, which is the more glamorous and the more that's the sort of more mass side that people really know about when it comes to blogging, is at the time all the mum bloggers were coming up. You know, it's so funny to think of it now, because people still buy that book and read it. And sometimes I got messages on Instagram saying, oh, I'm reading the book, I love it, I love it. And I'm like, oh God, it's so out of date now. Like, things have changed so much in terms of the platforms. But I think some of the fundamental principles remain the same.
Definitely. I mean, did you think when you were writing the book that we were just on the precipice of this huge influencer movement? Because
Yes, but not in the way that it transpired. So yes, I did. And it was obvious that people were going to take power, you know, ordinary people, through blogs and positioning, and their own sort of creativity were going to be a new form of media. So that was becoming apparent. I don't even think they were called influencers then. I mean, you probably know more than me. They were called bloggers, weren't they?
Yeah.
And in the Million Dollar Blog, social platforms and using them for amplification is covered. But no, I don't think anybody really foresaw that being a kind of Instagram influencer was going to become a viable career. And that wasn't that long ago. It was 2016. So it was in its infancy back then.
Yeah, we sort of went through blogger, vlogger, influencer, and now it seems to actually be changing a little bit to creator.
Yeah, yeah. And even blogger was, you know, blogging was touched upon in the book, Million Dollar Blog, but it really was all about websites and, you know, writing articles on people's websites.
And so then you launch Bolt Digital. What happens?
So, yeah, coming on to Bolt Digital, I had my 2 years where I was not allowed to work as a journalist because of this deal I'd done to sell Talk to the Press. So during that two years, I did a load of random stuff. You know, I went on a course about interior design. I went to college and learned video editing and website building. I went actually back to college and was a mature student. I joined an e-commerce franchise and set up an Amazon-only brand and became a trainer in that e-commerce franchise, and that's where I worked with Steve, who is now my business partner at Bolt Digital. Plus, I was sort of doing some, I renovated a house. I had some time off. I did a bit of being a lady who lunched and found it wasn't really for me. And then people were asking me for help with their online business. So I then started kind of doing freelance digital consultancy across a number of things, all similar things that I'd use within Talk to the Press to make it and give it industry-leading positioning. So that was really Google pay-per-click, building my personal brand and being an authority within the journalism niche, SEO and blogging and email marketing.
Well, this is the point as well, isn't it? Is that you started off as a journalist, but then you were taking those skills, becoming an entrepreneur. But actually then it's the, even with that, it's, you know, families and people wanting to sell the stories in. So it is, you know, marketing themselves.
Yeah,
so I suppose
yeah.
You've sort of done that shift. So it made sense.
Yeah.
With all those additional skill sets too.
Yeah, so there was a lot. And the other skill sets that have come out of running Talk to the Press was how to run an online business, which, and I didn't know that that was a set of skills that would become known as performance marketing skills. It was just me trying to make sure that my website continually ranked top of Google. And as I went out and about in this new period of my life talking to people, I came to realise that actually, you know, I used to look to America the whole time. I used to think, right, I ran a website and I go to America. I used to go to America to annual conferences to find out about how to do more advanced things with my website so I could always keep ahead of the sun and the mirror. And yeah. So I was very clued up in that space, extremely clued up, and I spent a lot of time and money investing in training and learning and looking to America and making sure I was on top of all the latest trends in terms of, you know, website conversion, SEO ranking, all that sort of stuff. And as I went out and about and met people and was doing freelance digital marketing, it really became clear to me that, wow, other people really didn't know this stuff. And in fact, I'd been doing it by that point for 7 or 8 years, and I had a really clear yeah. set of skills that once I could articulate them more clearly, it was then obvious that there was another business opportunity within this set of skills. Mm. Separately, because of writing the $1 million blog, Facebook had asked me to become an ambassador and trainer on their She Means Business program, which meant I was going up and down the country. You know, that program has trained, you know, over 100,000 female entrepreneurs in the UK, and I was one of their first 8 founding trainers. So I was going out and about, and I was also getting all this training from Facebook in order to go out and represent them, which is how I learned all about Facebook, Instagram and Facebook advertising. So I had a long time of doing a very broad set of digital marketing skills, which all kind of came together and enabled me to, first of all, do freelance work and subsequently kind of pivot that into Bolt Digital.
With Bolt Digital and then your first iteration of the offering, what was that and how has that changed over the years?
Oh, well, so it's such a great question, Alison, because it's changed so much. So our first iteration, so Steve, who is my business partner, and he sort of said, look, I had this little freelance business and it was perfectly fine. But the other thing I'd really learned from Talk to the Press and selling Talk to the Press actually was that I, in that first business, Talk to the Press, I'd been very much like, this is my business and I don't need any help and I'll do it all by myself. Now, Southwest News, who bought it from me, is a 3-generation company that's got 3 directors in it, but they're basically running the 3rd generation of business. It's a huge scale. And they'd approached me at various times and said, look, you know, what are you doing with Talk to the Press? You know, we should do it. They wanted to do a merger with me. And I'd been very resistant. Like, I didn't need any help. I don't want any help from you guys. This is my business. I'm fine. Anyway, when it came to me saying, okay, let's do this deal and let's sell it, by that point, I'd had 2 kids. I think I was quite run down. You know, I was extremely worn out. I hadn't had any maternity leave for either. You know, I think I was basically quite a low point. And when they took over the business and during the transition period and my exit, it was amazing for me to see what people with experience could give to me and the business. And I just remember thinking, I've been so sort of pig-headed in insisting that I knew it all myself, because in actual fact, if I'd merged with them a couple of years earlier, I might have, things could have been really different. So it was a real learning to me that I was very proud that I'd done it all myself, but I was also like really noted to myself that they did know a lot of things. They bought a huge amount of value. And all the time I've been thinking I didn't need any help, I possibly did actually need some help.
Financially, though, if you had have done the merger earlier, then your exit probably wouldn't have been as good, would it?
I don't know. No, I actually don't know, because they would have built it probably bigger and faster. I mean, I have no idea, because it's like those sliding doors moments. But I suppose for me, it's like, wow, I'd worked so much by myself and I'd then seen the benefit of expertise. And when Steve, who was my business partner at Bolt Digital, said to me, why don't we take this freelancing and grow it into an agency? My first thought was, I haven't done something with somebody else before. I've had the experience of doing it by myself. I'm very proud of that. I think it's a great thing to do things by yourself, particularly organising an exit as a woman as well. Like, that's all a great thing to do. But I was like, I've learned that actually there's benefit to working with other people. And so let's do this as a business partnership. Why not?
Yeah.
And let's see how that goes.
So you two in the business, you launch, who are your first clients and what are you offering them?
So we're basically offering anything digital to people who I was already working with or people I was meeting, because my reputation was spreading and I knew a lot of people and people saying, oh, can you help with this? Can you help with that? So it was quite a broad offering. The clients, they tended to be, mainly because of my network, in the kind of health and beauty space. So whether or not, and in the kind of aspirational lifestyle product space. So whether or not they were, clinics in Harley Street or brands, they were in that space that I knew very well, coming from the Daily Mail. And typically things we do for them would be organic social content, email marketing, website development. I mean, everything, right? It was a pretty broad offering. And I think a lot of businesses, I mean, actually, I think there's always that thing, how do you start a business? Do you come up with an amazing, clear niche idea where you know absolutely everything and spend however long in R&D and getting the perfect website and all this sort of stuff and launching it, which is great. Or a lot of people start how Pop Digital started, which is more of, right, we know we have capabilities and can help people. Let's get some clients and then start niching. So that period of niching was an interesting one because we knew that you can't, to be a, you know, we knew that just being a full service agency who do anything and everything is pretty not great, right? And it's not really what we wanted. And we wanted to be able to articulate clearly what we do as well. And then you're sort of thinking, okay, what do we know about? What are we passionate about? Who can we help best? And trying to narrow down the products at the same time you're growing your team and you need to take on clients in order to support the team that you're growing.
Yeah.
So it really is a process of iteration. You go around the houses quite a few times really thinking, should we offer this? Should we offer that? You know, you try things as well. So we at Bulk Digital, we've always, I mean, less so now, but we always did kind of trial and error. Like, let's offer, you know, obviously you need to know you can deliver what you're selling, but let's see if, let's articulate it this way. Let's talk to people about this product. Let's try this product until you start really narrowing. And that's how we niche, was through a process of iteration.
And you've niched down now to three main areas.
We only work with Shopify-based brands, and they're all health and beauty, in that health and beauty sector. And so we're an e-commerce advertising agency. The work that my team do is creative production of social-first adverts, performance marketing, and growth modelling. So we also have a very quite unusual, I think, for an agency approach, in that we really look at brands and we look at their finances and how the brands and the consumers are behaving in order to understand ahead of time, we can run some campaigns, but really, how is this business going to scale financially and what it's going to be worth? And that comes from both Steve and I having exited businesses before, that we instinctively know that this isn't just like selling some products. These are entrepreneurs, or whatever scale they're at, whether you're a £500,000 brand or a £100 million brand, you know, this is a business that has a value and people want to grow it and realize that value. So that's made us quite unique. And the way we work with brands is we either run their ad operations, so we the outsourced marketing department, we train in-house teams, or we train smaller brands in groups.
So what would you say, since starting, then Bulk Digital has been your biggest client success story? And what does success look like for you with a client?
Oh, that's such a great question. So I think there's different measures of success. So the brand, the success story that made Bulk Digital the most famous and the one we're most well known for is that of Absolute Collagen. So I know you know Maxine, who's the founder of Absolute Collagen. She was at an event I was doing for Facebook, and she came up to me holding a box of Absolute Collagen. At the time, she was doing about £1,000 a month through her website. She was working with her daughters, but really by herself. She'd remortgaged her house. She didn't know if it was going to work. So we took that brand, and we had various conversations with Maxine, and ended up becoming their fully outsourced marketing department. We took them from £1,000 a month to £1 million a month in revenue, which was a fantastic result, you know, Absolute Collagen.
Wow.
Since growing on, so since that, we worked with them for about 3 years doing everything, the fully outsourced, the whole marketing structure from Maxine's personal brand, and creating Maxine as the figurehead of that brand. And exactly as I'd done for myself and talked to the press with Maxine, there was so much more you could say, and really creating not her character, it is who she is, but bringing her to the forefront, making Maxine famous. To everything, we did everything for them, marketing-wise, digital marketing-wise. And as that brand grew, you know, it was very obvious the brand was, people were really loving the products and, you know, and that the brand was growing extremely fast, and Maxine prepared to have her first round of investment into it. So they built an in-house team. That's the brand. So one of our success stories is that, because it's clearly an amazing result to have created alongside Maxine and her team, Absolute Collagen. And we're still friends with Maxine today. She just spoke at our recent conference.
They've just launched their hair care as well.
Yeah,
they've
relaunched their hair care. You know, other success stories, we are working with brands like the Inky List. We've trained their in-house team, up-leveled their in-house D2C team, and completed a three-month training upskilling project with them, which has been really, really successful. So I suppose measures of success are what happens to the brand in terms of their revenue and their capabilities. But also we've worked through our training and events a lot of much smaller brands who you can't say, oh, you know, we took them £1,000 a month to £1 million a month. But if you're training the entrepreneur to understand their business and to understand the things they need to do and to know how to take next steps, which is the work we do with the smaller brands that come to our events and training days, and to, you know, to feel empowered over their business and really understand for the first time how this business, what this business is, how it operates, how they can drive value into it, how they can see the wood for the trees, then that is also a success in my view, alongside the great stories of the likes of Absolute Collagen and the Inky List.
When you know, you have these smaller brands and or they've got to a point where they can now maybe afford to have an agency, what would you say to those brands in things to look out for when considering working for an agency? And then, you know, what are the green flags, I suppose, and also what would you say are the red flags?
You know, we see lots of brands who are looking to work with agencies, and most of them are too small to work with us, because we do tend to work with brands now whose annual ad spend is millions of pounds as opposed to tens or hundreds of thousands. I think the red flags are, when looking for an agency, are if an agency promises they can get you this or that in results, that's like me saying, I promise you it's going to be sunny tomorrow. It's like these are predictions that you can't make. So it's, you know, very easy. Well, you know, one of the things you can do as an agency is be like, oh, we're going to get you better results. We're going to get you this type of return. And that's really hard to predict. So, and I think it's not honest of agencies. That's one of the reasons we developed an accelerator program, because obviously we get asked that all the time. And if other agencies are out pitching, we're going to get you this, we're going to get you that, then people ask us that too. And we always say, look, we just refuse to answer that question. It's like, I don't have a crystal ball. We haven't worked with your brand. We don't know your audiences. We have no idea about how it feels to market your product or how people respond to that marketing. How can I possibly make a definite prediction about what outcome we're going to get? And that's one of the reasons we developed what we call our accelerator program, which again is something we've become really well known for, where we put brands through a 2 to 3 month testing period so that then we can make some assumptions about their future. But based on at least 2 to 3 months of actual working with them and working with their products and running their marketing. Now, that's still not enough time for you to be able to see the future. Obviously, none of us can see the future, but it's certainly enough time to be able to have some understanding of, okay, you know, fundamentally, what drives the success of an e-commerce brand is its unit economics and how the customers behave. So it gives us some chance to get to know the unit economics and see how the customers behave to then look at what could happen in the future. So one of the red flags I would say would be if an agency promises to get you results. I think in terms of green flags, I mean, actually, I'm going to say it from our point of view, what we look for in brands when we're thinking about working with them, if they're smaller, do they have any green shoots? So are we seeing that we can acquire customers at an acceptable rate? Are we seeing that the customers spend an appropriate amount on the first order? Are we seeing that these customers are returning within 30, 60, 90 day periods? Is there any signs of life in this brand? Or, you know, we do look at brands and sometimes you know that they just are not, are they really, really going to struggle?
Yeah.
And they're not, the underlying metrics are wrong, and really no amount of money or marketing or investment can solve that. More often, and you look at brands, you say, okay, this brand is able to do this, it's strong in this area, but they're going to have to do this work here and that work there, and then you're saying it's got green shoots, you can see a path to what they need to do. So we're very careful about who we work with and only work with brands where they have green shoots or are already successful in scaling.
Obviously, the podcast, we do have a, you know, we concentrate on the influencer creator piece as well. I know that you have done work with creators that's not at the absolute forefront of the agency. But just quickly before we get on how you've worked with influencers before, what advice would you give? Because what we're seeing now within the market is that a lot of creators are launching their own direct-to-consumer brands, you know, in health and beauty and fashion. When they are, you know, talking of green shoots, as soon as they launch, they're going to have, because they've already got those audiences, you know, committed to them, will get lots of sales straight away. But what's your advice then in future-proofing that? Because as you said before, the biggest thing you learned from your the business course was that it isn't just about the founder. And, you know, to scale a business, it has to, you have to let go of the founder in ways.
Yeah, and I think it depends what they want as an individual. Because if you're taking a blogger who, or an influencer who wants a nice income and a sort of lifestyle business, then, you know, having an audience, doing deals with brands, and then launching a product to that audience makes perfect sense. And that can be a very viable, very lovely, relatively lucrative way to lead one's life, in which you don't need to future-proof it at all. You just need to carry on doing what you're doing. I think other influencers have come into the market where they're a lot more ambitious. They may have had investment off brands, off venture capital funds, and they launch a product and it goes very well because they have this amazing power and ability to launch a product. They then do have to be, I mean, you know, when we say people don't like, or funds don't want founders to be involved in brands, that's not the case. Like, they're happy to have that. But then that person needs to be very clear that their role is really the front end sales and promotion. And they need to bring in the team to do all the rest of the elements that will come into a fast growing business.
Yeah. And so then on the second part of that question, or rather maybe the first, how have you worked with creators at Bolt Digital? And how do you see that continuing in the future?
Oh, yeah, I mean, they're super important. And I love this division now between influencers and creators, in that some people may be amazing creators, but not be massively fussed about being an influencer. They're just, you know, almost like want to create and happy to have a following, but they're not trying to be the biggest influencer in the world. So, you know, human-based content from the off of my career in media has been really important. You know, magazines are filled with true stories and real people. The national news and newspapers are filled with real people, true stories and real experiences. And it's the same for brands. So when we look at the advertising assets we have in play for a brand, you know, well, they'll often give us a load of stuff from a model, and it's all very, it's brilliant, right? Some of the stuff, if you look at a brand like The Inky List, the incredible shoot assets and video assets that they have, but they're very branded. Models, yeah. You know, studio environments. So we're looking across an array of assets and we're thinking, right, what are the assets that we know bring people in? It's that sort of stuff. It's media articles and it's real women demonstrating products, talking about the results and benefits. So it's often the case that we work with brands and they're very short of real women or creator type content. They may have done a few pieces of influencers, but they won't have the appropriate licensing rights for that content to be repurposed for an advertising channel. So in that instance, we look to work with brands. We look to bring in creators who are not influencers, but are creators to record, yeah. To try products, demonstrate, record, and record the content that they think is appropriate based on their experience with using that product.
Have you ever sort of tried to help the brands negotiate with influencer content to get those licensing?
So they will, if they're at the size where they're using influencers and don't have those agreements, then they'll typically have an influencer agency or someone in house managing influencers. We always say to them, from the moment they encounter us, what are the licenses you've got with these people, and can these licenses be amended historically or and moving forward, can you please get full usage licenses with anyone you're doing this sort of content with? Because it's just about getting the most value from an asset that's being created for you. So to have an influencer create an asset and publish it on their channels is brilliant. To have an influencer create an asset and then give you that asset for you to use in your own advertising is even better.
Yeah. But do you sort of advise the brands that maybe that will short-term cost more, but in the long-term be more valuable? And because we're seeing a lot of agencies now around these usage rights, that's been the thing that's sort of changing now. Everyone's talking about usage rights, and I suppose that's an extra layer of charge that's being put on.
by influencer agencies.
Yeah.
Definitely an extra layer of charge that's being put on, but that's because the market's becoming more sophisticated, and I think that's to be expected. So whether or not it's got long-term more value, you actually don't know until you've tested the, until you've got the cost, because also everyone's, there's not sadly a universal pricing tier for this type of stuff, is there? There's a load of basically individual rates and different agencies and all that sort of stuff. So the general principle we would advise, so you need to actually get the asset and deploy it into advertising to know whether the short-term cost hike is going to result in more long-term gain on an individual asset basis, but as a principle it does. So as a principle, what works in messaging, what works in communication is what's always worked, which is a mix of, you know, factual studies, this product works, brand stuff, here's some nice models using it, and oh, and here's a load of customers talking about it. Those are kind of, you know, ongoing principles of the world in which we live in, and principles of advertising which will continue. So one can surmise that over the long term, any influencer assets that you pay more for to bring back into your campaigns and get more life from, more longevity from, will be beneficial to you over the long term. But we can't give exact figures because every brand is different, every influencer charges different rates, every agency layers on a different level of cost before usage.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's still a, but I think the fact that more and more agencies are talking about that and influencer agencies see it as an upsell is just a factor of the market maturing.
And do you think that there'll be some more standardisation across the market?
I mean, I used to think that in the story selling market, so where in my previous business, where we basically have a load of businesses selling in content into the media and there's no standardisation of pricing. No, I think it's impossible unless influencers publish their rates. You know, it would just be impossible. It's too much of a fragmented market for that to happen.
With some of the clients that you have, do they will have an influencer agency and work with you as well? So do you have many dealings with the influencer? Are you kind of looped into campaigns together? And is there, you know, what are your experiences? What have they been? Have you had like good experiences of agencies, bad experiences? Is it, do you think, getting better?
We haven't had any bad experiences with influencer agencies. I mean, there's a big British heritage brand we're working with right now on their global campaigns, and we work with their influencer agency alongside. So for instance, they will have a shoot meeting and all the agencies are invited to that, and we'll all discuss what we each want them to get from that shoot.
What do you think about the people that are trying to make influencer purely performance marketing, or that's how they view it?
How do you see them as measuring it, that type, just so I can,
just that they don't really, there isn't this sort of brand sentiment piece, it's more we're using this creator purely to get this amount of clicks, and the, you know, that it's like buying a Facebook ad, we're just buying it, and it sort of loses
So that's just the game, the markets, the diversification across the market. So there's a lot of people who do that, and it's the same as what we do. Where there's an ability to measure, I see it going in oscillation. Where there's an ability to measure and get clarity on the outcome of your campaigns, people go wholly into that and then get very focused on it. So it then becomes a thing, because there is that famous saying that you're advertised, you don't know what works and what doesn't work. And so where there's a hint that you can get a measure, people really focus on it. But what then happens is you then realise that all this measurement, as sophisticated as it is, still doesn't give you a true, absolute source of truth on, you know, what happened with that influencer in that campaign. Same with what happened in that paid advertising campaign. So then what we call blended KPIs start coming in, where they say, okay, you know, there is some a halo effect, or it's not just about the direct sales. And the way I've always seen influencers is it's much more akin to publicity than it is akin to, say, actual performance marketing in the way we do performance marketing. And, you know, you can't even get 100% clarity on performance marketing metrics. But really, what's your influencer? I always see it as a PR first thing, a brand first thing. You know, it's reach, awareness, endorsement.
Yeah, aligning with that influencer's values.
Yeah, and it's just like, oh, here's Grazia magazine covering our face cream. Here's this influencer covering our face cream. For me, it's a PR first activity. So, but obviously, once you get wind, I mean, you know, if there was some way to measure PR, well, there was, wasn't there? People would talk about it, you know, your column inches, financial value, you paid for this. So as soon as there's a way to measure
value,
people sort of focus on it, and then they realise actually it's not just about this one metric.
Yeah, I think people can sort of get stuck in a bit of a linear view, but actually
They definitely can, and it's really frustrating because, in fact, the world is more fragmented than ever. So if you think back to just 10 years ago or 12 years ago, really, you wanted to launch your brand, you were literally going straight for PR, and you had, what, 5 national newspapers and 10 magazines you wanted to get it into. Grazia, Marika, the Daily Mail, and that was it. Those were really your options, and maybe if you were lucky, you'd get it on This Morning. Now, and people were quite happy with that. Brands still launched, they were still successful, brands still grew. Now there's a million and one ways from however many choosing whoever out of however many influencers doing paid advertising. So there's more fragmentation, but actually people's inside, they have a goal for more measurement, which is fair enough. But when you layer on how we behave as humans, you think it's very difficult to measure, because look at how we behave on our phones. If I just think about myself, during the day, I literally yo-yo between Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, the Daily Mail website, Safari. You know, my attention is fragmented as well. So you have a media landscape which is fragmented and now contains many elements of the media which you didn't have before, social advertising, influencers. You have an attention landscape which is completely fragmented, and then people really want to measure direct results, so it doesn't actually line up.
Do you, in your predictions for the future, do you think we will get to a point where it is, you know, more aligned? What are your main predictions for the marketing industry, and also where do you see Bolt Digital in 18 months time?
Bolt Digital is definitely becoming, or already is, sort of the leading growth partner in the UK for Shopify based brands. And through our event series, we now have 2 annual conferences called D2C Live, networking and training. And the support we have from our sponsors, people like Recharge, Gorgeous, Shopify, Akendo, these are the key apps within the Shopify ecosystem. That is clearly on a path to just become bigger and bigger. And I'd like, you know, Bolt Digital will continue to work with bigger brands running global campaigns. So I think that's the path for Bolt Digital. We will stay.
How important are those 2 events, would you say? And what are your views then on the on events within, this industry, and how important the face-to-face is?
Yeah, I think it's super important. I mean, I think for us, it's hugely important, because at first it allows us to reach more people at scale. You know, we're not a big agency in terms of working with dozens of brands. We don't do that. We only really work with sort of 8 to 12 brands at any one time. So it enables us to reach and impact more people. And it just means more people will be talking about Bolt Digital, will be talking about the event. Plus, it enables us to really connect in our speaker sourcing, enables us to connect with some of the real leaders in the industry. So I think events are really, really important.
Mm-hmm. And then I cut you off just as you were saying something else about your 18 months time with Bolt Digital.
So Bolt Digital will stay focused on our core competencies within our agency, which is paid advertising, so digital advertising channels and creative production and storytelling. And we support brands in other areas, but don't implement on those other areas anymore. So we know a lot about a lot of things, but the core work we do is the work that we are best at. In terms of, you asked for a prediction in the advertising, you said, do you think it will become more linear? No, I mean, how can it? You know, it's only going to get more and more fragmented. There's no option than that, because there's only going to be a new app that comes along, and we all love, you know, Facebook last year surreptitiously launched Facebook Glasses, you know, which you can take a phone call through and record videos. You know, they will soon, I mean, they haven't been mass adopted yet. I do believe that this tech they've done in conjunction with Ray-Ban is probably the closest that anyone's got to mass tech through wearables such as glasses. And as that does, if mass adoption of that does happen, then you've got a whole new kind of hardware channel through which to reach people. So then it'll be like, oh, did you see us advertising on Instagram on your phone, or did you see us advertising on Google Maps on your glasses? You know, there's only going to be more channels, more fragmentation, the influencer industry as well. You know, there's more and more people wanting to do it, unsurprisingly. So there's going to be more and more influencers and creators. So everything will, I see, is just becoming more fragmented. Then you'll have then digital TV channels. So no, I don't see how it can become more linear at all. If anything, you know, communication is going to have to be more omni-channel. You know, we already at Bolt Digital talk about helping brands see, hear, think and learn. It's helping consumers see, hear, think and learn about brands. And that basically means we help them see, i.e. on the digital advertising channels where they can watch videos, etc., Facebook, Instagram, the usual. Hear, audio channels, you know, Spotify, podcast advertising. It's really important. You've seen a brand on Facebook to then hear about it on Spotify. Think and feel comes down to the type, I think and learn comes down to the type of content that we produce. So educational content and emotional based content, telling stories of brands through those visual and auditory channels.
That's a very good answer. And then my final question for you, which is, currently, what is your favourite social media platform to use personally and why?
So my favourite social media platform right now is TikTok. Highly addictive.
For consumption or creation? Or
no,
both?
For consumption. So I haven't, you know, we do run campaigns on TikTok for the brands that we work with, but, you know, but just noticing, I'm always noticing how my own behaviour changes, and therefore what does that mean for what digital and the work we do. No, for consumption, I mean, there's just so much on it. Its algorithm learns very quickly what you want to watch, so you only have to like a few things and you see more of them. But the pace of that channel, it does kind of, and also I think the coverage of the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard case on TikTok has really brought a lot more people into it a lot of the time, because of the way in which the TikTok creators are summarising that case in ways that are both very eloquent and sort of interesting and make you think, but also, you know, there's a load of amusing kind of content on there as well about it. So it's an incredible landscape for diversity of content. The one thing that does worry me about TikTok, but there's nothing we can do about it, it's like, that's like being worried about evolution, is just how experiencing that channel will only further diminish our attention spans. You know, our swipe through rates on that channel is so high. So fast, it's like, no, yeah, not interested, I'll watch this one. Swipe. You know, I see my kids on it, and it's like, you know, it's all this sort of stuff that people worry about social media. You can see that playing there. I think my view on it is, though, well, what can you do? Trying to battle it is like battling evolution. It is a channel.
Yeah.
It has, people are moving to it en masse. It is a fast-paced environment. There's nothing that can be done about that apart from to experience it and then take a view on whether you want to be a part of it or not.
I do think that it's interesting at the same time, though, that we have seen such a rise in podcasts and people, you know, choosing to listen to half an hour, 40 minutes.
Yeah, and that's another channel that is doing extremely well. It's not one that I massively, you know, I look at what will take my time. I do listen to podcasts, but the channel I'm most into is TikTok because of its kind of unique mix of pace, education and entertainment, I think, makes it a very interesting place to hang out.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com.